Thank you for that introduction. Just kind of getting started off, it's just going to be some general background knowledge. The bollworm, or if you want to call it corn ear worm, the scientific name is Helica verbosa. It's in the Noctuidae family, and it undergoes complete metamorphosis, meaning that it has an egg, larval, pupil, and an adult stage. They're known to have multiple generations per year, and they're also a polyphagous species. So a little bit more information on them being polyphagous. They're known to feed on more than 100 host plants. You typically notice your early season populations established in wild host species such as crimson clover. As your agricultural crops begin to mature and develop, you'll notice populations shift into them, and some of these crops include sorghum, corn, cotton, and soybeans, among others. So just some information on the effects that bollworms have in cotton. So typically, early overposition preferences, which would be in your pre-flowering cotton or in the upper one-third region of the canopy. As the cotton matures and flowers, you'll notice overposition sites tend to shift lower, and you'll start noticing egg lay on bloom tags. So upon hatch out, larvae directly feed on surrounding plant structures. A lot of times it's the terminal. And then as they develop, they'll shift to your fruiting forms, starting with squares and then to flowers and bowls. The overall result of their feeding, it would be the abscission of fruiting forms and the reduction in yield. So prior to 1996, pretty much the main form of control of bollworm was chemical and probably, I guess you could say, cultural, you know, just doing your timing to try to avoid heavy pressure and flights. So like I said, 1996, that's when Bolgar was introduced. It was the first transgenic cotton expression of BT. It expressed a single gene, and it was introduced for budworm, pink bollworm, and it was also noted that it had some control effects on bollworm populations. Now, shortly after the introduction, a lot of your growers started noticing that they weren't getting as effective control using this Bolgar, especially under high bollworm population densities. So in 2003, Bolgar 2 was introduced. This used the same gene, but in addition to it, it used the Cry2AB gene. So this provided a much better form of control for your bollworm populations, and it also gave additional control for species like some of your army worms. So looking at some data from 2000, and this is in between after Bolgar came out and the introduction of Bolgar 3, this is looking at fruiting form damage on a per larvae basis. You'll notice as you shift from a non-BT cotton to Bolgar and then to Bolgar 2, there's a drastic decline in square damage. But if you look at your boll damage, this is where Bolgar kind of failed out at, because it wasn't providing effective control once these larvae got down to the bolls. But like I said earlier, Bolgar 2 provided a better control measure, as you'll notice that it was significantly less damage in it. So these are just a couple of journal articles that I have posted up here. The first was that of a field study that was looking at larval movement behavior in BT cotton. So traditionally, looking in your non-BT cotton varieties, upon hatch out, that larvae will feed on the surrounding area and then move to squares in that upper region of the plant, and as they develop, they'll move down and feed in the blooms and the bowls. Now, at the time when Bolgar and Bolgar 2, more emphasis on Bolgar 2, came out, there was a noticeable difference. The larvae were actually able to detect and avoid that high-expressing region of the plant and shift directly towards your flowers and then towards your bowls. So on the study that I have on the right was a lab study, and it basically sums up the same thing, where you see that zero at is basically an untreated diet disc. All the rest of the disc incorporated some form of BT in it. So essentially, that larvae fed and completely destroy that one disc before ever moving throughout the rest of the petri dish to find another food source. So when you combine this, their ability to detect and avoid the high expression regions of the plant, and also the variability you get in BT expression throughout the plant and over the course of the growing season, that could be, you know, a potential cause for the problems that we're dealing with today. So speaking of just some resistance problems, this is just some data done by Dr. David Kearns. It's looking at resistant ratios and populations of boll worms. So, and it's also looking at the Cry1AC and Cry2AB gene. So in 2016, it was noted that two populations, the ratio for resistance was significant for both Cry1AC and Cry2AB. But as you shifted towards 2017, all populations found had a very high resistance ratio for that of the Cry1AC, and then all but three showed similar results in the Cry2AB. So just a couple of my objectives that I did some experiments on over the summer. The first is the study of larval behavior in transgenic and non-transgenic cotton varieties. And the second one was to determine larval feeding preference in a controlled setting, which is very similar to that lab study that I just mentioned. So we started out the summer, or actually right before the summer, we made some collections at a Crimson Clover around Vicksburg. And then we made another collection out of non-BT and double pro hybrids about midsummer, and we reared those in the lab. So looking at my first objective, we planted strip plots using Delta Pine cotton varieties, and these included a non-BT, a Bolgar 2, and a Bolgar 3. Once we reached about five nodes above white flower, that's when we triggered the experiment, and we isolated individual plants to prevent inter-plant movement of larvae, and we infested each plant with a single two-day-old larvae, or let me rephrase that. They had fed on diet for 2 days, but essentially 2 days old. And we placed each larvae in a white flower of each individual plant, and we tagged that for the later observations. We made our observations at 3, 7, 9, and 11 days after we infested it, basically just to look at, you know, where they're moving to, what they're feeding on, and how much they're feeding. So after we got done with the experiment, we analyzed the data with proc-glimics with a 0.05 significant level. So this is the cumulative fruiting form damage across the treatments, and it's on a per larvae basis. The top number is the total. You'll notice that there is a difference, but after analyzing it with that proc-glimics, that there was no significant difference in boll damage between non-BT and Bolgar 2. The significance was actually on the square damage aspect. You were getting some protection from boll worms in the Bolgar 2. Now, in the Bolgar 3, at that initial check at 3 days, we didn't recover any live larvae. I saw a few dead ones, but we didn't see any live larvae or any damage, actually. So just kind of comparing it to 2000, what you see on for the non-BT, that could just be some variation. But what I want you to really focus on is that of the Bolgar 2. If you put this in a proportion perspective, at the 2000 experiment, you're looking at, I think it was about 1% in proportion from non-BT to Bolgar 2 to non-BT. Now, you look at 2018, it's 33% damage in squares. So also just looking at the boll damage comparison on a per larvae basis between non-BT and Bolgar 2, there was a drastic increase between the two time periods in boll damage. So pretty much these larvae are just able to eat whatever they want, especially in the bowls. So for objective two, we pulled leaves out of that the same plots. We pulled around the third node. We also pulled small squares near the terminal because those were really the only ones that would fit in those petri dishes. They're relatively small. And we placed them in the petri dish, and we used two-day-old larvae and infested each petri dish. And we made observations at 24, 48, and 96 hours after we infested just to see what plant tissue they were preferring, if they were preferring it. So, and after we ran it, we used a chi-square analysis. So I just kind of wanted to bring back up that information I put in the early part of the presentation, is that, you know, that larvae was detecting the expression of BT, so it went straight to, I guess, what you just call your check disc before ever looking for another food source. Now, you look at my experiment of 2018, that really the feeding is random. And if I could blow up that bottom section or that bottom BT disc, there's actually more feeding on it than both the non-BTs. So just looking at the data, you'll notice that there is, the difference in the 24-hour period was a little bit more drastic, but really that's mainly because we still had larvae that were not feeding on any form of leaf tissue. They were still seeking out something. But as you shift towards that 48-hour period and then the 96, it started leveling out. And after analyzing and looking at the p-value, it basically just sums up that it's that there is no preference, or you can't really justify a preference. And we had a similar result for that of square damage. Again, that 24-hour period, you still have larvae trying to seek out food sources, and kind of gives you some inconsistencies. But as you get to that 48-hour period and so on, you're getting more feeding on both non-BET and the Bolgar 2 squares. So in conclusion, larvae are more tolerant to the dual gene expressing varieties, so that means there is increased feeding, and it doesn't seem like it's affecting them as much as what it used to. And there is no significant evidence now that non-BT and BT tissues affect feeding preference of larvae, which is rather interesting because listening to some of these talks talking about, you know, the buildup and resistance, I mean, this could be a contributing factor. And I wanted just to mention this last conclusion. This is just some of my other research, but even though we may not be killing a lot of these larvae, it's still affecting their weight gain, because I did some, and I mean, it was probably about their weight was probably about 30% of that of a non-BT. So with that, I would like to thank Cotton Incorporated, the USDA, and Mississippi State for funding and contributions. I would also like to thank all my advisors and fellow graduate students and summer workers, because I really could not do it without them. And I would like to take any questions at this time.
Have any questions for us? I have one. Did you see any mortality transitioning from diet to tissue, from taking the two-day-old worms from diet to putting them on tissue?
I think I had one die. I did it some more. I did start seeing some mortality, but you know, the early studies, it really performed well. And I'm actually going to be starting that whenever we get back from Beltwide soon. Get the lab colonies beefed up and then start working some more. We got some cotton growing in the greenhouse in Stoneville.
Any other questions? All right. Thank you, Russ.
Thank you.